against his throat. It would be a way out, he thought, an easy way out. And if there's anyone who'd simply take it in their stride, who'd just clean up the mess and get on with things, it's the two guys sitting downstairs at the kitchen table drinking their beer. No more worries. No more Laura. No more mysteries and conspiracies. No more bad dreams. Just peace and quiet and rest forever. One clean slash, ear to ear, that's all it'll take. He stood there with the razor against his throat. A tiny smudge of blood came from the place where the blade touched the skin. He had not even noticed a cut. See, he told himself, and he could almost hear the words being whispered in his ear. It's painless. Too sharp to hurt. I'll be gone before I know it. Then the door to the bathroom swung open then, just a few inches, enough for the little brown cat to put her head around the door frame and murr up at him, curiously. Hey, he said to the cat, I thought I locked that door. He closed the cutthroat razor, put it down on the side of the sink, dabbed at his tiny cut with a toilet paper swab. Then he wrapped a towel around his waist and went into the bedroom next door. His bedroom, like the kitchen, seemed to have been decorated sometime in the 1920s. There was a washstand and a pitcher beside the chest of drawers and mirror. Someone had already laid out clothes for him on the bed. A black suit, white shirt, black tie, white undershirt and underpants, black socks, black shoes set on the worn Persian carpet beside the bed. He dressed himself. The clothes were of good quality, although none of them were new. He wondered who they had belonged to. Was he wearing a dead man's socks? Would he be stepping into a dead man's shoes? He adjusted the tie in the mirror, and now it seemed to him that his reflection was smiling at him sardonically. Now it seemed inconceivable to him that he had ever thought of cutting his throat. His reflection continued to smile as he adjusted his tie. "Hey," he said to it, "you know something that I don't?" And immediately felt foolish. The door creaked open, and the cat slipped between the doorpost and the door and padded across the room, then up on the windowsill. "Hey," he said to the cat, "I did shut that door. I know I shut that door." She looked at him, interested. Her eyes were dark yellow, the color of amber. Then she jumped down from the sill onto the bed, where she wrapped herself into a curl of fur and went back to sleep, a circle of cat upon the old counterpane. Shadow left the bedroom door open so the cat could leave and the room air a little, and he walked downstairs. The stairs creaked and grumbled as he walked down them, protesting his weight as if they just wanted to be left in peace. "Damn, you look good," said Jacquel. He was waiting at the bottom of the stairs and was now himself dressed in a black suit similar to Shadow's. "You ever driven a hearse?"
"No."
"First time for everything, then," said Jacquel. "It's parked out front." An old woman had died. Her name had been Lila Goodchild. At Mr. Jacquel's direction, Shadow carried the folded aluminum gurney up the narrow stairs to her bedroom and unfolded it next to her bed. He took out a translucent blue plastic body bag, laid it next to the dead woman on the bed, and unzipped it open. She wore a pink nightgown and a quilted robe. Shadow lifted her and wrapped her, fragile and almost weightless, in a blanket and placed it onto the bag. He zipped the bag shut and put it on the gurney. While Shadow did this, Jacquel talked to a very old man who had, when she was alive, been married to Lila Goodchild. Or rather, Jacquel listened while the old man talked. As Shadow had zipped Mrs. Goodchild away, the old man had been explaining how ungrateful his children had been, and grandchildren, too, though that wasn't their fault, that was their parents. The apple didn't fall far from the tree, and he thought he'd raise them better than that. Shadow and Jacquel wheeled the loaded gurney to the narrow flight of stairs. The old man followed them, still talking, mostly about money and greed and ingratitude. He wore bedroom slippers. Shadow carried the heavier bottom end of the gurney down the stairs and out onto the street, then he wheeled it along the icy sidewalk to the hearse. Jacquel opened the hearse's rear door. Shadow hesitated, and Jacquel said, "Just push it on in there. The supports'll fold up out of the way." Shadow pushed the gurney, and the supports snapped up, the wheels rotated, and the gurney rolled right onto the floor of the hearse. Jacquel showed him how to strap it in securely, and Shadow closed up the hearse, while Jacquel listened to the old man who had been married to Lila Goodchild, unmindful of the cold, an old man in his slippers and his bathrobe, out on the wintry sidewalk, telling Jacquel how his children were vultures, no better than hovering vultures, waiting to take what little he and Lila had scraped together, and how the two of them had fled to St. Louis, to Memphis, to Miami, and how they wound up in Cairo, and how relieved he was that Lila had not died in a nursing home, how scared he was that he would. They walked the old man back into the house, up the stairs to his room. A small TV set droned from one corner of the couple's bedroom. As Shadow passed it, he noticed that the newsreader was grinning and winking at him. When he was sure that no one was looking in his direction, he gave the set the finger. "They've got no money," said Jacquel when they were back in the hearse. "He'll come in to see Ibis tomorrow. He'll choose the cheapest funeral. Her friends will persuade him to do her right, give her a proper send-off in the front room, I expect. But he'll grumble. Got no money. Nobody around here's got money these days. Anyway, he'll be dead in 6 months, a year at the outside." Snowflakes tumbled and drifted in front of the headlights. The snow was coming south. Shadow said, "Is he sick?" "It ain't that. Women survive their men. Men like him, don't live long when their women are gone. You'll see. He'll just start wandering. All the familiar things are going to be gone with her. He gets tired, and he fades, and then he gives up, and then he's gone. Maybe pneumonia will take him, or maybe it'll be cancer, or maybe his heart will stop. Old age, and all the fight gone out of you. Then you die." Shadow thought. "Hey, Jacquel?"
"Yeah."
"Do you believe in the soul?" It wasn't quite the question he had been going to ask, and it took him by surprise to hear it coming from his mouth. He had intended to say something less direct, but there was nothing less direct that he could say.
"Depends. Back in my day, we had it all set up. You lined up when you died, and you'd answer for your evil deeds and for your good deeds. And if your evil deeds outweighed a feather, we'd feed your soul and your heart to Ahmet, the eater of souls."
"He must have eaten a lot of people."
"Not as many as you'd think. It was a really heavy feather. We had it made special. You had to be pretty damn evil to tip the scales on that baby. Stop here, that gas station. We'll put in a few gallons."
The streets were quiet, in the way that streets only are when the first snow falls. "It's going to be a white Christmas," said Shadow as he pumped the gas.
"Yep. Shit. That boy was one lucky son of a virgin."
"Jesus?"
"Lucky, lucky guy. He could fall in a cesspit and come up smelling like roses. Hell, it's not even his birthday, you know that? He took it from Mithras. You run into Mithras yet? Red Cap, nice kid."
"No, I don't think so."
"Well, I've never seen Mithras around here. He was an army brat. Maybe he's back in the Middle East, taking it easy, but I expect he's probably gone by now. It happens. One day every soldier in the Empire has to shower in the blood of your sacrificial bull. The next, they don't even remember your birthday."
Swish went the windshield wipers, pushing the snow to the side, bunching the flakes up into knots and swirls of clear ice. A traffic light turned momentarily yellow and then red, and Shadow put his foot on the brake. The hearse fishtailed and swung around on the empty road before it stopped. The light turned green. Shadow took the hearse up to 10 miles per hour, which seemed enough on the slippery roads. It was perfectly happy cruising in second gear. He guessed it must have spent a lot of its time at that speed holding up traffic.
"That's good," said Jacquel. "So, yeah, Jesus does pretty good over here, but I met a guy who said he saw him hitchhiking by the side of the road in Afghanistan, and nobody was stopping to give him a ride, you know? It all depends on where you are."
"I think a real storm's coming," said Shadow. He was talking about the weather. Jacquel, when eventually he began to answer, wasn't talking about the weather at all.
"You look at me and Ibis," he said. "We'll be out of business in a few years. We got savings put aside for the lean years, but the lean years have been here for a long while. And every year they just get leaner. Horace is crazy, really bugfuck crazy. Spends all his time as a hawk. Eats roadkill. What kind of a life is that? You've seen Bast, and we're in better shape than most of them. At least we've got a little belief to be going along with. Most of the suckers out there have barely got that. It's like the funeral business. The big guys are going to buy you up one day, like it or not, because they're bigger and more efficient and because they work. Fighting's not going to change a damn thing, because we lost this particular battle when we came to this green land 100 years ago, or 1,000 or 10,000. We arrived, and America just didn't care that we'd arrived. So we get bought out, or we press on, or we hit the road. So yes, you're right. The storm's coming."
Shadow turned onto the street where the houses were. All but one of them dead, their windows blind and boarded.
"Take the back alley," said Jacquel.
He backed the hearse up until it was almost touching the double doors at the rear of the house. Ibis opened the hearse and the mortuary doors, and Shadow unbuckled the gurney and pulled it out. The wheeled supports rotated and dropped as they cleared the bumper. He wheeled the gurney to the embalming table. He picked up Lila Goodchild, cradling her in her opaque bag like a sleeping child, and placed her carefully on the table in the chilly mortuary, as if he were afraid to wake her.
"You know I have a transfer board," said Jacquel. "You don't have to carry her."
"Ain't nothing," said Shadow. He was starting to sound more like Jacquel. "I'm a big guy, it doesn't bother me." As a kid, Shadow had been small for his age, all elbows and knees. The only photograph of Shadow as a kid that Laura had liked enough to frame showed a solemn child with unruly hair and dark eyes standing beside a table laden high with cakes and cookies. Shadow thought the picture might have been taken at an embassy Christmas party, as he had been dressed in a bow tie and his best clothes. They had moved too much, his mother and Shadow, first around Europe, from embassy to embassy, where his mother had worked as a communicator in the Foreign Service, transcribing and sending classified telegrams across the world, and then, when he was 8 years old, back to the U.S., where his mother, now too sporadically sick to hold down a steady job, had moved from city to city, restlessly spending a year here or a year there, temping when she was well enough. They never spent long enough in any place for Shadow to make friends, to feel at home, to relax. And Shadow had been a small child. He had grown so fast. In the spring of his 13th year, the local kids had been picking on him, goading him into fights they knew they could not fail to win, and after which Shadow would run, angry and often weeping, to the boys' room to wash the mud or the blood from his face before anyone could see it. Then came summer, a long, magical 13th summer, which he spent keeping out of the way of the bigger kids, swimming in the local pool, reading library books at poolside. At the start of the summer he could barely swim. By the end of August he was swimming length after length in an easy crawl, diving from the high board, ripening to a deep brown from the sun and the water. In September he had returned to school to discover that the boys who had made him miserable were small, soft things, no longer capable of upsetting him. The two who tried it were taught better manners, hard and fast and painfully. And Shadow found that he had redefined himself. He could no longer be a quiet kid. Doing his best to remain unobtrusively at the back of things, he was too big for that. Too obvious. By the end of the year, he was on the swimming team, and the weightlifting team, and the coach was courting him for the triathlon team. He liked being big and strong. It gave him an identity. He'd been a shy, quiet, bookish kid, and that had been painful. Now, he was a big, dumb guy, and nobody expected him to be able to do anything more than move a sofa into the next room on his own. Nobody until Laura. Anyway. Mr. Ibis had prepared dinner. Rice and boiled greens for himself and Mr. Jacquel. "I am not a meat-eater," he explained, "while Jacquel gets all the meat he needs in the course of his work." Beside Shadow's place was a carton of chicken pieces from KFC and a bottle of beer. There was more chicken than Shadow could eat, and he shared the leftovers with the cat, removing the skin and crusty coating, then shredding the meat for her with his fingers. "There was a guy in prison named Jackson," said Shadow as he ate. "Worked in the prison library. He told me that they changed the name from Kentucky Fried Chicken to KFC because they don't serve real chicken anymore. It's become this genetically modified mutant thing, like a giant centipede with no head, just segment after segment of legs and breasts and wings. It's fed through nutrient tubes. This guy said the government wouldn't let them use the word chicken." Mr. Ibis raised his eyebrows. "You think that's true?" "Nope. Now, my old cellmate, Low Key, he said they changed the name because the word fried had become a bad word. Maybe they wanted people to think that the chicken cooked itself." After dinner, Jacquel excused himself and went down to the mortuary. Ibis went to his study to write. Shadow sat in the kitchen for a little longer, feeding fragments of chicken breast to the little brown cat, sipping his beer. When the beer and the chicken were gone, he washed up the plates and cutlery, put them on the rack to dry, and went upstairs. By the time he reached the bedroom, the little brown cat was once more asleep at the bottom of the bed, curled into a fur crescent. In the middle drawer of the vanity, he found several pairs of striped cotton pajamas. They looked 70 years old, but smelled fresh, and he pulled on a pair which, like the black suit, fitted him as if they had been tailored for him. There was a small stack of Reader's Digests on the little table beside the bed, none of them dated later than March 1960. Jackson, the library guy, the same one who had sworn to the truth of the Kentucky Fried Mutant Chicken creature story, who had told him the story of the black freight trains that the government uses to haul political prisoners off to secret Northern Californian concentration camps, moving across the country in the dead of the night. Jackson had also told him that the CIA used the Reader's Digest as a front for their branch offices around the world. He said that every Reader's Digest office in every country was really CIA. "A joke," said the late Mr. Wood in Shadow's memory. "How can we be sure the CIA wasn't involved in the Kennedy assassination?" Shadow cracked the window open a few inches. Enough for fresh air to get in, enough for the cat to be able to get out onto the balcony outside. He turned on the bedside lamp, climbed into bed, and read for a little, trying to turn off his mind, to get the last few days out of his head, picking the dullest-looking articles in the dullest-looking digests. He noticed he was falling asleep halfway through "I Am John's Pancreas." He barely had time enough to turn out the bedside light and put his head down on the pillow before his eyes closed for the night. Later, he was never able to recollect the sequences and details of that dream. Attempts to remember it produced nothing more than a tangle of dark images. There was a girl. He had met her somewhere, and now they were walking across a bridge. It spanned a small lake in the middle of a town. The wind was ruffling the surface of the lake, making waves tipped with white caps, which seemed to Shadow to be tiny hands reaching for him.
"Down there," said the woman.
She was wearing a leopard print skirt which flapped and tossed in the wind, and the flesh between the top of her stockings and her skirt was creamy and soft, and in his dream, on the bridge, before God and the world, Shadow went down to his knees in front of her, burying his head in her crotch, drinking in the intoxicating jungle female scent of her. He became aware, in his dream, of his erection in real life, a rigid, pounding, monstrous thing as painful in its hardness as the erections he'd had as a boy when he was crashing into puberty. He pulled away and looked upward, and still he could not see her face. But his mouth was seeking hers, and her lips were soft against his, and his hands were cupping her breasts, and then they were running across the satin smoothness of her skin, pushing into and parting the furs that hid her waist, sliding into the wonderful cleft of her, which warmed and wetted and parted for him, opening to his hand like a flower. The woman purred against him ecstatically, her hand moving down to the hardness of him and squeezing it. He pushed the bedsheets away and rolled on top of her, his hand parting her thighs, her hand guiding him between her legs, where one thrust, one magical push. Now he was back in his old prison cell with her, and he was kissing her deeply. She wrapped her arms tightly around him, clamped her legs about his legs to hold him tight so he could not pull out, not even if he wanted to. Never had he kissed lips so soft. He hadn't known that there were lips so soft in the whole world. Her tongue, though, was sandpaper rough as it slipped against his. "Who are you?" he asked. She made no answer, just pushed him onto his back and, in one lithe movement, straddled him and began to ride him. No, not to ride him, to insinuate herself against him in series of silken smooth waves, each more powerful than the one before. Strokes and beats and rhythms which crashed against his mind and his body just as the wind waves on the lake splashed against the shore. Her nails were needle-sharp, and they pierced his sides, raking them, but he felt no pain, only pleasure. Everything was transmuted by some alchemy into moments of utter pleasure. He struggled to find himself, struggled to talk, his head now filled with sand dunes and desert winds. "Who are you?" he asked again, gasping for the words. She stared at him with eyes the color of dark amber, then lowered her mouth to his and kissed him with a passion, kissed him so completely and so deeply that there, on the bridge over the lake, in his prison cell, in the bed in the Cairo funeral home, he almost came. He rode the sensation like a kite riding a hurricane, willing it not to crest, not to explode, wanting it never to end. He pulled it under control. He had to warn her. "My wife, Laura, she will kill you."
"Not me," she said.
A fragment of nonsense bubbled up from somewhere in his mind. In medieval days it was said that a woman on top during coitus would conceive a bishop. That was what they called it, trying for a bishop. He wanted to know her name, but he dared not ask her a third time, and she pushed her chest against his, and he could feel the hard nubs of her nipples against his chest, and she was squeezing him, somehow squeezing him down there, deep inside her, and this time he could not ride it or surf it. This time it picked him up and spun and tumbled him away, and he was arching up, pushing into her as deeply as he could imagine, as if they were in some way part of the same creature, tasting, drinking, holding, wanting.
"Let it happen," she said,
her voice a throaty feline growl.
"Give it to me. Let it happen."
And he came, spasming and dissolving, the back of his mind itself liquefying, then sublimating slowly from one state to the next. Somewhere in there, at the end of it, he took a breath, a clear draught of air he felt all the way down to the depths of his lungs, and he knew that he had been holding his breath for a long time now. 3 years, at least. Perhaps even longer.
"Now rest,"
she said, and she kissed his eyelids with her soft lips.
"Let it go. Let it all go."
The sleep he slept after that was deep and dreamless and comforting. And Shadow dived deep and embraced it. The light was strange. It was, he checked his watch, 6:45 a.m. and still dark outside, but the room was filled with a pale blue dimness. He climbed out of bed. He was certain that he'd been wearing pajamas when he went to bed, but now he was naked, and the air was cold on his skin. He walked to the window and closed it. There had been a snowstorm in the night. 6 inches had fallen, perhaps more. The corner of the town that Shadow could see from his window, dirty and run down, had been transformed into somewhere clean and different. These houses were not abandoned and forgotten. They were frosted into elegance. The streets had vanished completely, lost beneath a white field of snow. There was an idea that hovered at the edge of his perception. Something about transience. It flickered and was gone. He could see as well as if it were full daylight. In the mirror, Shadow noticed something strange. He stepped closer and stared, puzzled. All his bruises had vanished. He touched his side, pressing firmly with his fingertips, feeling for one of the deep pains that told him he had encountered Mr. Stone and Mr. Wood, hunting for the greening blossoms of bruise that Mad Sweeney had gifted him with, and finding nothing. His face was clear and unmarked. His sides, however, and his back, he twisted to examine it, were scratched with what looked like claw marks. He hadn't dreamed it then. Not entirely. Shadow opened the drawers and put on what he found, an ancient pair of blue denim Levi's, a shirt, a thick blue sweater, and a black undertaker's coat he found hanging in the wardrobe at the back of the room. He wore his own old shoes. The house was still asleep. He crept through it, willing the floorboards not to creak, and then he was outside, and he walked through the snow, his feet leaving deep prints on the sidewalk. It was lighter out than it had seemed from inside the house, and the snow reflected the light from the sky. After 15 minutes of walking, Shadow came to a bridge, with a big sign on the side of it warning him he was now leaving historical Cairo. A man stood under the bridge, tall and gangling, sucking on a cigarette and shivering continually. Shadow thought he recognized the man, and then, under the bridge in the winter darkness, he was close enough to see the purple smudge of bruise around the man's eye, and he said, "Good morning, Mad Sweeney." The world was so quiet. Not even cars disturbed the snowbound silence. "Hey, man," said Mad Sweeney. He did not look up. The cigarette had been rolled by hand. "You keep hanging out under bridges, Mad Sweeney," said Shadow. "People are going to think you're a troll." This time Mad Sweeney looked up. Shadow could see the whites of his eyes all around his irises. The man looked scared. "I was looking for you," he said. "You got to help me, man. I fucked up big time." He sucked on his hand-rolled cigarette, pulled it away from his mouth. The cigarette paper stuck to his lower lip, and the cigarette fell apart, spilling its contents onto his ginger beard and down the front of his filthy T-shirt. Mad Sweeney brushed it off, convulsively, with blackened hands, as if it were a dangerous insect. "My resources are pretty much tapped out, Mad Sweeney," said Shadow. "But why don't you tell me what it is you need? You want me to get you a coffee?" Mad Sweeney shook his head. He took out a tobacco pouch and papers from the pocket of his denim jacket and began to roll himself another cigarette. His beard bristled and his mouth moved as he did this, although no words were said aloud. He licked the adhesive side of the cigarette paper and rolled it between his fingers. The result looked only distantly like a cigarette. Then he said,
"I'm not a troll. Shit. Those bastards are fucking mean."
"I know you're not a troll, Sweeney," said Shadow gently. "How can I help you?" Mad Sweeney flicked his Zippo, and the first inch of his cigarette flamed and then subsided to ash.
"You remember I showed you how to get a coin, you remember?"
"Yes," said Shadow. He saw the gold coin in his mind's eye, watched it tumble into Laura's casket, saw it glitter around her neck. "I remember."
"You took the wrong coin, man."
A car approached the gloom under the bridge, blinding them with its lights. It slowed as it passed them, then stopped, and a window slid down.
"Everything okay here, gentlemen?"
"Everything's just peachy, thank you, officer," said Shadow. "We're just out for a morning walk."
"Okay now," said the cop.
He did not look as if he believed that everything was okay. He waited. Shadow put a hand on Mad Sweeney's shoulder and walked him forward, out of town, away from the police car. He heard the window hum closed, but the car remained where it was. Shadow walked. Mad Sweeney walked, and sometimes he staggered. The police car cruised past them slowly, then turned and went back into the city, accelerating down the snowy road.
"Now, why don't you tell me what's troubling you?" said Shadow.
"I did it like he said. I did it all like he said, but I gave you the wrong coin. It wasn't meant to be that coin. That's for royalty, you see. I shouldn't even have been able to take it. That's the coin you'd give to the King of America himself, not some pissant bastard like you or me. And now I'm in big trouble. Just give me the coin back, man. You'll never see me again if you do. I swear to fucking Bran, okay? I swear by the years I spent in the fucking trees."
"You did it like who said, Sweeney?"
"Grimnir, the dude you call Wednesday. You know who he is? Who he really is?"
"Yeah, I guess."
There was a panicked look in the Irishman's crazy blue eyes.
"It was nothing bad. Nothing bad. He just told me to be there at that bar and to pick a fight with you. He said he wanted to see what you were made of."
"He tell you, do anything else?"
Sweeney shivered and twitched. Shadow thought it was the cold for a moment, then knew where he'd seen that shuddering shiver before, in prison. It was a junky shiver. Sweeney was in withdrawal from something, and Shadow would have been willing to bet it was heroin. A junky leprechaun? Mad Sweeney pinched off the burning head of a cigarette, dropped it on the ground, put the unfinished, yellowing rest of it into his pocket. He rubbed his dirt-black fingers together, breathed on them to try and rub warmth into them. His voice was a whine now.
"Listen, just give me the fucking coin, man. I'll give you another just as good. Hell, I'll give you a shitload of the fuckers."
He took off his greasy baseball cap. Then, with his right hand, he stroked the air, producing a large golden coin. He dropped it into his cap. And then he took another from a wisp of breath steam, and another, catching and grabbing them from the still morning air until the baseball cap was brimming with them, and Sweeney was forced to hold it with both hands. He extended the baseball cap filled with gold to Shadow.
"Here," he said. "Take them, man. Just give me back the coin I gave to you."
Shadow looked down at the cap, wondered how much its contents would be worth.
"Where am I going to spend those coins, Mad Sweeney?" Shadow asked. "Are there a lot of places you can turn your gold into cash?"
He thought the Irishman was going to hit him for a moment, but the moment passed and Mad Sweeney just stood there, holding out his gold-filled cap with both hands, like Oliver Twist. And then tears swelled in his blue eyes and began to spill down his cheeks. He took the cap and put it, now empty of everything except a greasy sweatband, back over his thinning scalp.
"You got a man," he was saying. "Didn't I show you how to do it? I showed you how to take coins from the hoard. I showed you where the hoard was. Just give me that first coin back. It didn't belong to me."
"I don't have it anymore." Mad Sweeney's tears stopped, and spots of color appeared in his cheeks.
You fucking...
he said, and then the words failed him, and his mouth opened and closed wordlessly. I'm telling you the truth, said Shadow. I'm sorry. If I had it, I'd give it back to you, but I gave it away. Sweeney's grimy hands clamped on Shadow's shoulders, and the pale blue eyes stared into his. The tears had made streaks in the dirt on Mad Sweeney's face.
Shit,
he said. Shadow could smell tobacco and stale beer and whiskey sweat.
You're telling the truth, you fucker. Gave it away and freely and of your own will. Damn your dark eyes. You gave it a fucking way.
I'm sorry. Shadow remembered the whispering thump the coin had made as it landed in Laura's casket.
Sorry or not, I'm damned and I'm doomed.
He wiped his nose and his eyes on his sleeves, muddying his face into strange patterns. Shadow squeezed Mad Sweeney's upper arm in an awkward male gesture.
"'Twere better I had never been conceived,' said Mad Sweeney at length.
Then he looked up.
"'The fellow you gave it to, would he give it back?'
"'It's a woman, and I don't know where she is, but no, I don't believe she would.' Sweeney sighed mournfully.
"'When I was but a young pup,' he said, "'there was a woman I met under the stars "'who let me play with her boobies, "'and she told me my fortune. "'She told me that I would be undone "'and abandoned west of the sunrise, "'and that a dead woman's bauble would seal my fate. "'And I laughed.' "'and poured more barley wine and played with her boobies some more, "'and I kissed her full on her pretty lips. "'Those were the good days. "'The first of the grey monks had not yet come to our land, "'nor had they ridden the green sea to westward. "'And now—'
"'He stopped mid-sentence. "'His head turned and he focused on Shadow.
"'You shouldn't trust him,'
he said reproachfully. "'Who?'
"'Wednesday. You mustn't trust him.'
"'I don't have to trust him. I work for him.'
"'Do you remember how to do it?'
"'What?' Shadow felt he was having a conversation with half a dozen different people. The self-styled leprechaun sputtered and jumped from persona to persona, from theme to theme, as if the remaining clusters of brain cells were igniting, flaming, and then going out for good.
"'The coins, man, the coins! I showed you, remember?'
He raised two fingers to his face, stared at them, then pulled a gold coin from his mouth. He tossed the coin to Shadow, who stretched out a hand to catch it, but no coin reached him.
"'I was drunk,' said Shadow. "'I don't remember.'
Sweeney stumbled across the road. It was light now, and the world was white and gray. Shadow followed him. Sweeney walked in a long, loping stride, as if he were always falling, but his legs were there to stop him, to propel him into another stumble. When they reached the bridge, he held onto the bricks with one hand and turned and said,
"'We got a few bucks. I don't need much. Just enough for a ticket out of this place. 20 bucks will do me fine. Just a lousy 20.'
"'Where can you go on a $20 bus ticket?' asked Shadow.
"'I can get out of here,' said Sweeney. I can get away before the storm hits, away from a world in which opiates have become the religion of the masses, away from—"
He stopped, wiped his nose on the side of his hand, then wiped his hand on his sleeve. Shadow reached into his jeans, pulled out a 20, and passed it to Sweeney. "Here." Sweeney crumpled it up and pushed it deep into the breast pocket of his oil-stained denim jacket, under the sew-on patch showing two vultures on a dead branch, and beneath them the words, "'Patience, my ass, I'm going to kill something.' He nodded.
"'That'll get me where I need to go,' he said.
He leaned against the brick, fumbled in his pockets until he found the unfinished stub of cigarette he had abandoned earlier. He lit it carefully, trying not to burn his fingers or his beard.
"'I'll tell you something,' he said, as if he had said nothing that day. "'You're walking on gallows ground, and there's a rope around your neck and a raven bird on each shoulder waiting for your eyes, and the gallows tree has deep roots, for it stretches from heaven to hell, and our world is only the branch from which the rope is swinging."
He stopped. "I'll rest here a spell," he said, crouching down, his back resting against the black brickwork.
"Good luck," said Shadow.
"Hell, I'm fucked," said Mad Sweeney.
"Whatever. Thanks."
Shadow walked back toward the town. It was 8 a.m., and Cairo was waking. He glanced back to the bridge and saw Sweeney's pale face, striped with tears and dirt, watching him go. It was the last time Shadow saw Mad Sweeney alive.
This ends Disc 7. American Gods, Disc 8.
The brief winter days leading up to Christmas were like moments of light between the winter darknesses, and they fled fast in the House of the Dead. It was the 23rd of December, and Jaquel and Ibises played host to a wake for Lila Goodchild. Bustling women filled the kitchen with tubs and with saucepans and with skillets and with Tupperware, and the deceased was laid out in her casket in the funeral home's front room with hothouse flowers around her. There was a table on the other side of the room laden high with coleslaw and beans and cornmeal hush puppies and chicken and ribs and black-eyed peas, and by mid-afternoon the house was filled with people weeping and laughing and shaking hands with the minister, everything being quietly organized and overseen by the sober-suited Messrs. Jaquel and Ibis. The burial would be on the following morning. When the telephone in the hall rang, it was Bakelite and black and had an honest-to-goodness rotary dial on the front, Mr. Ibis answered. Then he took Shadow aside.
"That was the police," he said. "Can you make a pickup?"
"Sure."
"Be discreet. Here."
He wrote down an address on a slip of paper, then passed it to Shadow, who read the address, written in perfect copperplate handwriting, and then folded it up and put it in his pocket.
"There'll be a police car," Ibis added.
Shadow went out back and got the hearse. Both Mr. Jaquel and Mr. Ibis had made a point, individually, of explaining that, really, the hearse should only be used for funerals. And they had a van that they used to collect bodies, but the van was being repaired, had been for 3 weeks now, and could he be very careful with the hearse? Shadow drove carefully down the street. The snow plows had cleaned the roads by now, but he was comfortable driving slowly. It seemed right to go slow in a hearse, although he could barely remember the last time he had seen a hearse on the streets. Death had vanished from the streets of America, thought Shadow. Now it happened in hospital rooms and in ambulances. We must not startle the living, thought Shadow. Mr. Ibis had told him that they move the dead about in some hospitals on the lower level of apparently empty covered gurneys, the deceased traveling their own paths in their own covered ways. A dark blue police cruiser was parked on a side street, and Shadow pulled up the hearse behind it. There were two cops inside the cruiser, drinking their coffee from thermos tops. They had the engine running to keep warm. Shadow tapped on the side window.
"Yeah?"
"I'm from the funeral home," said Shadow.
"We're waiting for the medical examiner," said the cop.
Shadow wondered if it was the same man who had spoken to him under the bridge. The cop, who was black, got out of the car, leaving his colleague in the driver's seat, and walked Shadow back to a dumpster. Mad Sweeney was sitting in the snow beside the dumpster. There was an empty green bottle in his lap, a dusting of snow and ice on his face and baseball cap and shoulders. He didn't blink.
"Dead wino," said the cop.
"Looks like it," said Shadow.
"Don't touch anything yet," said the cop. "Medical examiner should be here any time now. You ask me, the guy drank himself into a stupor and froze his ass."
"Yes," agreed Shadow. That's certainly what it looks like. He squatted down and looked at the bottle in Mad Sweeney's lap. Jameson Irish whiskey. A $20 ticket out of this place. A small green Nissan pulled up, and a harassed middle-aged man with sandy hair and a sandy mustache got out, walked over. He touched the corpse's neck. He kicks the corpse, thought Shadow, and if it doesn't kick him back...
He's dead, said the medical examiner. Any ID?
He's a John Doe, said the cop. The medical examiner looked at Shadow.
You working for Jacquel and Ibis?
He asked. Yes, said Shadow.
Tell Jacquel to get dentals and prints for ID and identity photos. We don't need a post. He should just draw blood for toxicology. Got that? Do you want me to write it down for you?
No, said Shadow. It's fine. I can remember. The man scowled fleetingly, then pulled a business card from his wallet, scribbled on it, and gave it to Shadow, saying,
Give this to Jacquel.
Then the medical examiner said, Merry Christmas to everyone, and was on his way. The cops kept the empty bottle. Shadow signed for the John Doe and put it on the gurney. The body was pretty stiff, and Shadow couldn't get it out of a sitting position. He fiddled with the gurney and found that he could prop up one end. He strapped John Doe sitting to the gurney and put him in the back of the hearse, facing forward. Might as well give him a good ride. He closed the rear curtains, then he drove back to the funeral home. The hearse was stopped at a traffic light when Shadow heard a voice croak,
And it's a fine wake I'll be wanting, with the best of everything and beautiful women shedding tears and their clothes in their distress and brave men lamenting and telling fine tales of me in my great days.
You're dead, Mad Sweeney, said Shadow. You take what you're given when you're dead.
Aye, that I shall,
sighed the dead man sitting in the back of the hearse. The junky whine had vanished from his voice now, replaced with a resigned flatness, as if the words were being broadcast from a long, long way away, dead words being sent out on a dead frequency. The light turned green, and Shadow put his foot gently down on the gas.
But give me a wake tonight, nonetheless, said Mad Sweeney. Set me a place at table, and give me a stinking drunk wake tonight. You killed me, Shadow. You owe me that much.
I never killed you, Mad Sweeney, said Shadow. It's $20, he thought, for a ticket out of here. It was the drink and the cold killed you, not me. There was no reply, and there was silence in the car for the rest of the journey. After he parked at the back, Shadow wheeled the gurney out of the hearse and into the mortuary. He manhandled Mad Sweeney onto the embalming table as if he were hauling a side of beef. He covered the John Doe with a sheet and left him there with the paperwork beside him. As he went up the back stairs, he thought he heard a voice, quiet and muted, like a radio playing in a distant room, which said,
And what would drink or cold be doing killing me, a leprechaun of the blood? No, it was you losing the little golden sun killed me, Shadow. Killed me dead as sure as water's wet, and days are long, and a friend will always disappoint you in the end.
Shadow wanted to point out to Mad Sweeney that that was a kind of bitter philosophy, but he suspected it was the being dead that made you bitter. He went upstairs to the main house, where a number of middle-aged women were putting saran wrap on casserole dishes, popping the Tupperware tops onto plastic pots of cooling fried potatoes and macaroni and cheese. Mr. Goodchild, the husband of the deceased, had Mr. Ibis against a wall and was telling him how he knew none of his children would come out to pay their respects to their mother. "The apple don't fall far from the tree," he told anyone who would listen to him. The apple don't fall far from the tree. That evening, Shadow laid an extra place at the table. He put a glass at each place and a bottle of Jameson Gold in the middle of the table. It was the most expensive Irish whiskey they sold at the liquor store. After they ate, A large platter of leftovers left for them by the women, Shadow poured a generous tot into each glass, his, Ibis's, Jaquel's, and Mad Sweeney's. "So what if he's sitting on a gurney in the cellar?" said Shadow as he poured. "On his way to a pauper's grave tonight, we'll toast him and give him the wake he wanted." Shadow raised his glass to the empty place at the table. "I only met Mad Sweeney twice, alive," he said. "The first time I thought he was a world-class jerk with the devil in him. The second time I thought he was a major fuck-up, and I gave him the money to kill himself. He showed me a coin trick I don't remember how to do, gave me some bruises, and claimed he was a leprechaun. Rest in peace, Mad Sweeney." He sipped the whiskey, letting the smoky taste evaporate in his mouth. The other two drank, toasting the empty chair along with him. Mr. Ibis reached into an inside pocket and pulled out a notebook, which he flipped through until he found the appropriate page, and he read out a summarized version of Mad Sweeney's life. According to Mr. Ibis, Mad Sweeney had started his life as the guardian of a sacred rock in a small Irish glade over 3,000 years ago. Mr. Ibis told them of Mad Sweeney's love affairs, his enmities, the madness that gave him his power. A later version of the tale is still told, although the sacred nature and the antiquity of much of the verse has long been forgotten. The worship and adoration in his own land that slowly transmuted into a guarded respect and then, finally, into amusement. He told them the story of the girl from Bantry who came to the New World and who brought her belief in Mad Sweeney the leprechaun with her. For hadn't she seen him of a night, down by the pool, and hadn't he smiled at her and called her by her own true name? She'd become a refugee in the hold of a ship of people who had watched their potatoes turn to black sludge in the ground, who had watched friends and lovers die of hunger, who dreamed of a land of full stomachs. The girl from Bantry Bay dreamed, specifically, of a city where a girl would be able to earn enough to bring her family over to the New World. Many of the Irish coming into America thought of themselves as Catholics, even if they knew nothing of the catechism, even if all they knew of religion was the banshee who came to wail at the walls of a house where death soon would be, and Saint Bride, who was once Bridget of the two sisters, each of the three was a Bridget, each was the same woman, and tales of Finn, of Ashen, of Conan the Bald, even of the leprechauns, the little people, and was that not the biggest joke of the Irish, for the leprechauns in their day were the tallest of the mound folk. All this and more Mr. Ibis told them in the kitchen that night. His shadow on the wall was stretched and bird-like, and as the whiskey flowed, Shadow imagined it the head of a huge waterfowl, beak long and curved, and it was somewhere in the middle of the second glass that Mad Sweeney himself began to throw both details and irrelevancies into Ibis's narrative. "Such a girl she was, with breasts cream-coloured and speckled with freckles, with the tips of them the rich reddish pink of a sunrise on a day when it'll be bucketing down before noon, but glorious again by supper." And then Sweeney was trying, with both hands, to explain the history of the gods in Ireland, wave after wave of them, as they came in from Gaul and from Spain and from every damn place, each wave of them transforming the last gods into trolls and fairies and every damn creature until Holy Mother Church herself arrived, and every god in Ireland was transformed into a fairy or a saint or a dead king without so much as a by your leave. Mr. Ibis polished his gold-rimmed spectacles and explained, enunciating even more clearly and precisely than usual, so Shadow knew he was drunk. His words and the sweat that beaded on his forehead in that chilly house were the only indications of this. With forefinger wagging, that he was an artist and that his tales should not be seen as literal constructs, but as imaginative recreations, truer than the truth, and Mad Sweeney said, "I'll show you an imaginative recreation, my fist, imaginatively recreating your fucking face, for starters." And Mr. Jaquel bared his teeth and growled at Sweeney, the growl of a huge dog who's not looking for a fight but can always finish one by ripping out your throat. And Sweeney took the message and sat down and poured himself another glass of whiskey. "Have you remembered how I do my little coin trick?" he asked Shadow with a grin.
I have not.
If you can guess how I did it, said Mad Sweeney, his lips purple, his blue eyes beclouded, I'll tell you if you get warm.
It's not a palm, is it? Asked Shadow.
It is not.
Is it a gadget of some kind, something up your sleeve or elsewhere, that shoots the coins up for you to catch?
It is not that, neither. More whiskey, anybody?
I read in a book about a way of doing the miser's dream with latex covering the palm of your hand, making a skin-colored pouch for the coins to hide behind.
This is a sad wake for Great Sweeney, who flew like a bird across all of Ireland and ate watercress in his madness, to be dead and unmourned save for a bird, a dog, and an idiot. No, it is not a pouch.
Well, that's pretty much it for ideas, said Shadow. I expect you just take them out of nowhere. It was meant to be sarcasm, but then he saw the expression on Sweeney's face. You do, he said.
You do take them from nowhere. Well, not exactly nowhere, said Mad Sweeney. But now you're getting the idea. You take them from the hoard.
The hoard, said Shadow, starting to remember. Yes.
You just have to hold it in your mind, and it's yours to take from. The sun's treasure. It's there in those moments when the world makes a rainbow. It's there in the moment of eclipse and the moment of the storm.
And he showed Shadow how to do the thing. This time, Shadow got it. Shadow's head ached and pounded, and his tongue tasted and felt like flypaper. He squinted at the glare of the daylight. He had fallen asleep with his head on the kitchen table. He was fully dressed, although he had at some point taken off his black tie. He walked downstairs to the mortuary and was relieved but unsurprised to see that John Doe was still on the embalming table. Shadow pried the empty bottle of Jameson Gold from the corpse's rigor mortis fingers and threw it away. He could hear someone moving about in the house above. Mr. Wednesday was sitting at the kitchen table when Shadow went upstairs. He was eating leftover potato salad from a Tupperware container with a plastic spoon. He wore a dark gray suit, a white shirt, and a deep gray tie. The morning sun glittered on the silver tie pin in the shape of a tree. He smiled at Shadow when he saw him.
"Ah, Shadow, my boy. Good to see you're up. I thought you were going to sleep forever."
"Mad Sweeney's dead," said Shadow.
"So I heard," said Wednesday. "A great pity. Of course it'll come to all of us in the end."
He jerked on an imaginary rope somewhere on the level of his ear, and then jerked his neck to one side, tongue protruding, eyes bulging. As quick pantomimes went, it was disturbing. And then he let go of the rope and smiled his familiar grin.
"Would you like some potato salad?"
"I would not." Shadow darted a look around the kitchen and out into the hall.
"Do you know where Ibis and Jacquel are?"
"Indeed I do. They are burying Mrs. Lila Goodchild. Something that they would probably have liked your help in doing, but I asked them not to wake you. You have a long drive ahead of you."
"We're leaving?"
"Within the hour."
"I should say goodbye."
"Goodbyes are overrated. You'll see them again, I have no doubt, before this affair is done with."
For the first time since that first night, Shadow observed, the small brown cat was curled up in her basket. She opened her incurious amber eyes and watched him go. So Shadow left the house of the dead. Ice sheathed the winter-black bushes and trees as if they'd been insulated, made into dreams. The path was slippery. Wednesday led the way to Shadow's white Chevy Nova, parked out on the road. It had been recently cleaned, and the Wisconsin plates had been removed, replaced with Minnesota plates. Wednesday's luggage was already stacked in the back seat. Wednesday unlocked the car with keys that were duplicates of the ones Shadow had in his own pocket.
"I'll drive," said Wednesday. "It'll be at least an hour before you're good for anything."
They drove north, the Mississippi on their left, a wide silver stream beneath a gray sky. Shadow saw, perched on a leafless gray tree beside the road, a huge brown and white hawk, which stared down at them with mad eyes as they drove toward it, then took to the wing, and rose in slow and powerful circles.
Shadow realized it had only been a temporary reprieve, his time in the House of the Dead. And already it was beginning to feel like something that happened to somebody else. A long time ago.